it's a fight between David and Goliath, and it's very unequal. And in the end, the way money flows through our society is such a powerful instrument in shaping our society.
This is the podcast of the European Investigative Newsroom, Follow the Money. I'm your host, Emma de Chassignet, recording from Brussels. And as always, I'm joined by Follow the Money reporter and my co-host, Alexander Fanta in Vienna. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning, Emma.
Today, we've got a special treat for you. We're not just going behind the scenes of an article, but an entire book written by our colleague, Thomas Bulle. Money is power. And when too much of that power ends up in too few hands, it shapes everything. Who can afford a home, how our economy works, and even how strong our democracy is. And because that world is wrapped in an extremely technical language, most of us don't understand what's really happening. Our colleague Thomas wants to change that. His new book, Plenty of Money But Not For You, digs into how our financial system really works and how it could work differently. The English edition isn't out yet, but today we'll give you a preview. Welcome, Thomas. Thank you for joining us today.
Great to be here.
And Thomas, you studied financial economics and you've been writing about our financial systems for many years. And what is it that triggered you to start writing about this topic in the first place?
Well, it's just with most of the people that I write about in my book, my own fascination started with the financial crisis of 2008. I was a financial economist. I just graduated, and then the biggest financial crisis in modern history breaks out. So that's a great moment, you would think, but I was a bit ashamed that I didn't really understand what was happening. So I thought, okay, I need to learn more about the basic functioning of this system, because we were talking about a systemic breakdown. All banks were going down and the government had to step in. It seemed like to be the end of capitalism, and we were breaking all these rules about free markets, and there was government money going to the private sector, and I was just completely lost in what was happening, and I had to relearn how the system worked.
So even though this supposedly was your expertise when the financial crisis broke out, in reality, you could not really understand what was happening.
Yeah, and I think I wasn't the only economist. So I was watching television, I was reading news articles, and I was talking to my fellow students and even professors. They couldn't really explain what was happening. And it was only years after the actual crisis, I started to put together the pieces of the puzzle.
And what are the flaws in our financial system that the 2008 crisis exposed?
What was happening was the banks were breaking down because they had overvalued mortgage portfolios on their balance sheets. And that was caused by lending out too much money for buying homes, especially in the US. They kind of overvalued everything and it all came crashing down. And then the banks stopped lending each other money. So they didn't trust each other anymore. And that caused a whole breakdown of the system. So it turned out all these banks were interconnected. They all loaned out money to each other. And I was asking this question, like, where does all this money come from? And that was like a big question that a lot of people were asking. And I discovered, well, there's not like a set amount of money going around in the world. There's constantly money creation. There's new money flowing into the system. And I learned that banks create new money whenever they provide loans. So they could just provide more and more mortgage loans and create more and more money. And that would make the prices go up. But once the sentiment turned and they stopped creating new money, then the markets came down. And this money creation became something that really fascinated me. And I met a lot of young people at the time that were asking these questions as well. And they started movements for monetary reform. And that's the groups that I followed over the years. And I write about them in my book.
And something your research also shows is that our money at banks is not even real money, but just the promise of money. And what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so all the money in your bank account, we call it deposits, which means the bank owes you something. You can exchange this number in your account for the public money, the notes in your wallet. So that's bank money. And that is money that banks can create more of. Whenever they provide a loan, they create new money. So it's not the existing money of savers that's being loaned out to borrowers. It is new money that is being created. So if you borrow money to buy a house, the bank creates new money in your account and they own the mortgage. And in my book, I write about central bankers who later admitted, well, I didn't know it actually worked like that. I didn't know commercial banks could create new money by providing loans. And we all know that this works quite well in normal times when everybody has trust in the system. So we keep our money at the bank. But if everybody asks for their money back at the same time, you have a bank run. And then, well, the bank would normally go bankrupt because they would have to sell their assets really quickly. And if all of the banks do that at the same time, it's complete panic. The central bank and the governments have to backstop the whole system. So it's ultimately backed by public money.
And after exploring the flaws in our system for years, what made you realize that this is something you, in fact, wanted to write a book about?
It's such an important topic, the design of our financial system. But to address this, we need more financial literacy. We need to understand how our system works. And we need to pay attention to the political landscape. There's a lot of lobbying going on. There's parties who have an interest in keeping the system as it is because they profit from it. And they are very powerful. And the people who are fighting for the public goods, that's just a very small group of people like citizens' movements and a few scientists. So it's a fight between David and Goliath. And it's very unequal. And I think it's important that we pay a little more attention to it. And maybe then the system will improve because in the end, the way money flows through our society is such a powerful instrument in shaping our society.
Yeah, because I think that's also a very central message in your book. Our financial system shapes our lives, our society, and yet most people just simply do not understand how our financial system works, right?
Yeah, and that's really something that is missing from our political discussions. For a small period of time, it was center stage. So politicians were really debating whether the current design was the right design. But the measures they took were mostly to prop up the current system. So there was a lot of public money creation that was flowing through the channels of the financial system. This was called quantitative easing, difficult terminology for creating public money and using it to prop up the current system. So that money went mostly to big companies and very rich people. And I talk about these examples in my book where Bernard Arnault, the richest guy of Europe, and his company Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy, how he could borrow public money directly from the European Central Bank and use it to buy back his own shares, driving up the share prices, paying out dividends to himself and his family, and buying up competitors. So creating an even bigger monopoly. So these are effects that are all part of the plumbing of the current system. I feel that we should have more political debate about how to redesign the plumbing of the financial system. In the end, it all comes down to we do have a public system, but we've outsourced so much to commercial private companies, but they act in their own interests, which is understandable, but maybe then we should have something public next to it. So I really feel that we should have more political debate about how to redesign the plumbing of the financial system.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I think that's a really interesting question you're raising is, does the kind of expansion, kind of central banks pumping money into the economy, underwriting the expansion of private debt, do you think that fuel, does that make the rich richer, fuel inequality?
Yeah, it definitely does. It's the redistribution of wealth. And not in the sense that it's redistributing from the rich to the poor, but the other way around. And that is something that is also kind of recognized by the authorities. But at the time, they didn't have other options because within the European Union, it's mostly the European Central Bank doing all the work. That has been the recipe for the last 15 years. And policymakers there are not part of the democratic process. We cannot elect our central bankers. So it's our politicians who should also have some influence on the design of the system and not just the central bankers.
And a word you've used here a couple of times is the word plumbing. And when you say that, I'm wondering, so I think after the crisis of 2008, that was quite a general conception of we really need reforms. 15 years later, has that happened? Or is that actually why you're using the word plumbing? Because nothing has really changed.
Well, the things that have changed are within the current design. So there's not a fundamental redesign. In my book, I describe how a lot of scientists and citizens' movements have propagated these propositions of fundamental redesign. There's too much credit creation and money creation, and public and private interests are kind of mashed up, and we should separate these two. So they said there should be a public alternative to bank money in the digital world to discipline banks into not creating too much credit. And this will eventually lead to a safer system where we have a public part. And it may, in the end, also be a way to liberalize the private part of our financial system.
And speaking about financial redesign, we have also seen new alternatives to traditional banks emerge, such as cryptocurrency, which promised money that's not controlled by governments or banks and that anyone will be able to use freely. But do you think that those cryptocurrencies have actually shifted financial power from banks to ordinary people?
At first, I really welcomed these initiatives because I think it's great that just from the private sector, there were people saying, okay, we need to redesign money. Let's come up with something different. We have a digital coin, which is just always one Bitcoin. It's not backed by something else. There's no risk of bank runs. I really found that quite charming. But then when time passed, you see this whole ecosystem of other cryptocurrencies emerging. The original promise was it will be peer-to-peer, just people who can pay each other and save without intervention of big corporates and government institutions. But soon after you saw, okay, but if you actually want to use this and buy it, there were crypto exchanges emerging. There were big players stepping in. So they kind of mimicked the concentration of power within a few big institutions, just like we have in the current financial system.
So basically, cryptocurrency didn't really become this power to the people project that it had initially promised it would be.
Yeah, the big promise of peer-to-peer money ultimately became this crypto casino, and it didn't deliver on that promise. It's the promise of safe money, but it's being backed with risky assets. So it's really looks a lot like what banks have created, but then it's completely unregulated, so they can just do what they want to do.
It's the casino all over again.
It could be.
I feel we should also talk about the role of libertarianism, of, you know, crypto billionaires with a kind of very radical anti-state ideology. The whole cryptocurrency idea kind of really found its home among people who believe that the state should have no role in the economy, right? So, Thomas, how much does that still influence the crypto world we're seeing today?
Yeah, I think the libertarian community is a strong supporter of Bitcoin, and also now it kind of merged with government power since Trump was reelected, because he surrounded himself with people from this community. So Peter Thiel, David Sachs, Elon Musk, all three of them are former PayPal founders or CEO, and they're now really close to the government. So it's this kind of, the ideology isn't really pure anymore. So that's,
and it's the same Trump who, it's the same Trump who just like a couple of years ago said he believed Bitcoin was a scam, right? So that's very much opportunistic on both sides, I guess.
Yeah, the crypto companies funded his campaign, and now they want something in return, and they do get it. And now we see also banks and crypto companies and tech companies working together to kind of create this new layer of private money. And I think that's where the real discussion is right now. Do we want to privatize the system further, but keep it anchored to dollars and euros, and then have the public sector be just the backstop of this system? Or should we have a more active role of the public sector to just provide safe money and have a private sector which is not connected so much to this public system and can operate by itself? And I think that is really where the big discussion is about right now, and where the decisions need to be made. Do we want the public sector just to be the backstop of a private system, or do we want to have a more active role of governments and central banks and public institution in managing the money that we regular people and normal companies in our economy are going to use for pricing, for trading, for investing?
And then next to crypto, we also have the digital euro, which is a project that the European Central Bank has been developing since 2021. And what's that about?
The simplest way to understand it is that it's a digital form of cash money, so of banknotes in your wallet. It's a liability of the central bank, but in a digital form. So you could see it as having a bank account at the central bank, but it could be through an intermediary, but like the ultimate system is that your money is not private bank money, but central bank money. So there's no risk of a private institution in between. And you haven't loaned out your money to a private bank, just like what you do if you have a bank account, a regular bank account. You have safest money in our current system, central bank money, but in a digital form. So you can use it for payments in the digital world.
And in your book, you also quote someone who used to work at the European Central Bank called Fernández Ordóñez, who says that in fact, at the moment, we don't have a real monetary union in the EU. We just have a monetary union when it comes to cash. And he says a digital euro would in fact also be this next step into really creating this union.
Yeah, right now, your euro is really as safe as your banks and your government. And if we do have a digital euro, then it doesn't really matter from which country you are. You can have a certain amount of digital euros in your bank account, and that would be like the same money everywhere in every European country. That would be the ideal situation of this former central banker, Fernández Ordóñez, who became kind of a monetary reformer after he left the central bank.
So do you see this digital euro really as an opportunity to revolutionize our system?
Yeah, it could. And it's this whole, we have this strange setup. So with the developments in the US, with Trump really going for private stable coins, he has created this momentum for change, and Europe needs to answer. And you see that Christine Lagarde, who is the president of the European Central Bank, she's really pushing, like, this is the global euro moment, she's saying. We should have the euro become a more important currency in the world. But then if you actually look at what the central bank is designing, they have to compromise, because they are also the governing body of the banking sector. And their most important mandate is controlling inflation and having financial stability. And financial stability within our current system means maintaining the current system.
giving stability to commercial banks, essentially.
To commercial banks, exactly. And if so, they're really afraid that if they design the digital euro in the way that Ordóñez and these reformers would like to see, that they would actually destabilize the current banking system. Because then if you have something really safe for people to put their money on, it could mean that money from the current banking system is moving to this new digital euro account. And that would mean that commercial banks have to find other sources of financing. So they have to finance themselves with money that they attract from private markets. They would probably have to pay more than what they pay us on our bank accounts in interest. So it would become more expensive for them to fund themselves. So for the banks, it's really important that the digital euro remains something small, that it can become an alternative for payment, but not for saving, because that would drain our saving money from their accounts to the central bank account. And that is something they would not like to see. So this is a really difficult position for the central bank to be in. So on the one side, they want to move forward, create something new. On the other side, they want to not disrupt the current system. And they chose for a big compromise, saying we're just going to introduce the digital euro for payments. And that is what the European Commission put into a draft proposal for legislation right now.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, aren't the banks right to say that if, you know, basically the ECB suddenly runs most part of the banking system for most people, that will put them out of the business and, you know, kind of nationalize large parts of how people experience the financial system. You know, isn't that a quite radical thing to do for a very unclear payoff?
Well, it depends how you look at it. Cash money was much more important in the past. So right now, 90% of our money is bank money. But if you go back 50 years, that was like almost 50% was cash money. So you can also say that the central bank is really late. That has led to this privatization. Now they need to move back and take back a little bit of this money. So we have a little more public money in use in a digital form, because that fits to the current system.
How people benefit from that?
It could have a disciplining effect on the banking sector. And I would like to react on your first part. It's not really nationalizing banking. So banks can still provide credit, but they would just have to finance themselves differently. So what you create is an alternative public system for payments and basic savings. And if you have that, there's more room to say, okay, maybe we shouldn't backstop everything that commercial banks do. If we have a public alternative, it might have a disciplining effect on banks to not take excessive risks, because they know maybe they may not be saved like they were last time.
Yeah, and a research you actually did together, the two of you, was about this lobbying against the digital euro. And then that lobbying, was that mainly coming from banks for the reason that they thought, well, if this digital euro really goes through, we might be losing out on profit. Is that what your research on that showed?
So what we did is we obtained, you know, reams and reams of documents from the European Commission and from the European Central Bank, showing, you know, how hard banks and banking associations were lobbying, even, you know, way before the first real proposal for a law on the digital euro came through. And they were basically pushing, essentially what Thomas said before, they were pushing to have the role of the digital euro as a store of value as minimal as possible, not to allow people to actually keep their savings with the central bank, also allowing banks to keep digital euro deposits in a way they do with money now, you know, diminishing the role of the public sector in the digital currency. And, you know, it was quite clear what the bank's agenda was from these documents.
And so banks are concerned that they would lose profit and power, but there's also a lot of citizens that are quite concerned about the digital euro, right?
Yeah. you see that since the corona pandemic, there's a lot of people who've been suspicious of government power. And I think they are more suspicious now of government power than of bank power. And they feel that if the government has a digital form of money, they can spy on you. They know where you spend your money, and they are actually going to use that to steer your behavior. And yeah, that's based on not really on that, on evidence, but it's like reasoning from things that happened during the pandemic. But I think in the current proposal, that's actually the part that has been paid a lot of attention to, that actually the privacy placeholders are better than within the current banking system, because these same people often don't realize that banks, private banks, have all your payment data and they can use it for commercial purposes as well. So it's beneficial to the bankers, because they now can say, well, the citizens don't want it, we the banks don't want it, and we are developing something that can do the job as well. So the private banks have now in Europe are working on Vero, which is kind of a payment system that could make international payments between our countries faster and cheaper, and it would be an alternative to the American credit card schemes of Visa and MasterCard. And that is really now in the center of the discussion. And we see in the European Parliament right now, there is the rapporteur who's the one in charge of the Spanish Navarrete is his last name. He's now in charge of the digital euro in the European Parliament, and he's put forward this report where he says we need to make the development of the digital euro contingent on there not being a private solution. So he's really going against the development of an online digital euro that you can use for online payments. And
but
he's
essentially
really
saying that if banks turn out to be faster than the European Central Bank with developing a digital currency, then European Central Bank can essentially give up and have the private banks fix it.
Exactly. That's what he's saying. And you see that, again, the banks have been lobbying on this member of parliament. So he had 82 meetings. And two of them were with citizen groups, and about 35 were with banks and bank lobby groups, and the rest was with central banks and with other industry parties. So the private sector has had a lot of influence on his report, and you can see like the narrative of the banking sector is in his report.
But so just to recap, what are some of the core benefits that you think this digital euro could have really had it gone through in its more sort of radical form that we might be like missing out on now that we have such a compromise proposal?
It would have a public alternative for private money, and that benefit will only be felt once we allow people to have more money stored on this account. Then you would have a safe haven alternative for bank deposits, which would reduce credit risk on private institutions, private banks, for us normal citizens, so we can have money, save it, pay with it, and not run credit risk on a bank. And ultimately, that would allow us to scale down the safety nets and deposit insurance schemes, and that will save public money, because the current system is backstopped with public money, and we don't see it, but it will ultimately save money that can be spent on other things that are more beneficial than just maintaining the private system. And yeah, that could reduce moral hazard risk-taking from private institutions, which is now where the profits are going into private pockets, but the risks are shared by us all. And I think that's the bigger picture, which is completely out of focus right now, but could be the ultimate goal of having public money again in a digital form.
And on that note, we'll wrap up today's episode. You can find some of Thomas's research already on ftm.eu and stay tuned for what's coming out next. And thank you so much for joining us today, Thomas. And Alex
Great
and I will be back
here
soon. for another episode.
You've listened to the podcast of Follow the Money. Our watchdog journalism is funded by our members. Subscribe and support European investigative journalism.